In olden days, a glimpse of femur was only for morbid dreamers. But you're not alone. Bring anything round. Two goofy gals with deathly interest go on a skeleton inquest in your headphones. Anything round.
Hello and welcome to Anything Bones. I'm Sophie Schwartz.
And I'm Caitlin Hart.
And this is the show where we talk about bones and bone-related topics.
Yeah, we bone around a lot.
But we're not boning alone today.
No, we're not.
We have a very special guest on the podcast today, Darren Schultz, comedian, theater artist, and bird enthusiast extraordinaire. Welcome to Bones.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How are your bones today?
Bones are good. I took like a pretty long walk yesterday for the first time in a while, but the bones are in good shape afterwards. No severe bone trauma involved.
No creakiness?
I don't think so.
How is the quarter-sized chunk that came out of your knee doing?
That is basically healed. The quarter-sized chunk of my knee that came out at the end of July. And then also the blisters I got about a week ago are also pretty much healed.
So nice to hear.
Yeah, I knew I was going to be doing this long walk yesterday when I got the blisters. And I was like, you got 1 week, bud, to heal those up because you got to go on this long walk.
Would you care to tell the listeners how you got blistered?
I work from home and was taking out some trash wearing a pair of not good shoes made by Tommy Bahama. with no socks because I thought I was just going outside and back, and then after walking out of my apartment I realized I locked myself out, so I had to walk only about 15 minutes to where my roommate's place of work is to pick up his keys. And by the time I had gotten there and started turning around, I checked the foot situation, and there was just already the skin was gone from the backs of my feet.
You don't like to see that.
You hate to see it because if it's still there, you know, you can like pop the blister or drain the blister, I guess, and then bandage it up and it'll like heal okay. But I was just starting to walk back and it was already past the point of like, oh, this is fucked.
Yeah, that sounds horrible. But thank you for making a new segment on our show called Pus Talk.
Pus Talk.
We can talk skin more. Not today, though.
No? No more skin today?
Today is about bones.
Yeah, we have to talk about bones. I'm sorry. I know you really like talking about chunks and skin and stuff.
Chunks, skin, the show Skins. Oh, my favorite.
That's a quality show. Oh my gosh, we should do an episode where we review an episode of Bones and an episode of Skins.
Or just building off of that, and what if we did something where we just like watched Bones for 12 hours and then we watched Skins for 12 hours and then we did a podcast?
This is seeming very worst idea of all time, but I'm into it. I'm down.
The exhaustion I feel like you'd hit would immediately be vanished when you switch from Bones to Skins and then probably creep back up pretty quickly. Like it would feel so good to switch shows and then you'd be tired of it already.
I think I would have to do Skins first because Skins is very depressing. And then you would have to parachute into Bones to save you.
Hmm.
Can I be honest? I've never seen the show Skins.
It's sad British teens, and they do a lot of drugs, and they have a lot of sex, and they make a lot of mistakes.
Is Skins like English slang for something?
It's like papers that you roll your cigarettes and weed in.
Ah.
Caitlin, do you want to start us off with a bone tale?
Yeah, I could do that. So, Darren, we talk about anything bones on this podcast. So I decided I was going to talk about a murder.
Okay.
This murder happened in Washington, North Carolina. So the city is Washington.
You really juked me on that one.
Yeah. We all live in the state of Washington, but this story takes place in Washington, North Carolina.
It's not even the second most well-known Washington in the country.
No. But it probably, I don't know if it's older than the state of Washington. I
almost
didn't bother to look it up, but it's got to be on the, it's probably near a colony, one of those 13, you know?
That's
you know, the colony of Washington?
No, the colony of North Carolina. I am an American citizen, but I don't really know what's going on. Anyway.
That's what makes you an American citizen.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Sick burn. All right, so it's July 25th, 1988. Police respond to an emergency call in Washington, North Carolina, where they find a couple. The man is Leith Von Stein, and he has been stabbed and beaten to death. Wife, Bonnie Von Stein, has been stabbed and also beaten, but she's alive. Intrigued?
Yes.
This happens at their family home, and Bonnie's daughter, Leith's stepdaughter, Angela, is there too. She's 18. She was found in the next room. She's totally fine. She said she slept through the attack.
Wow, that's lucky.
Detectives that are assigned to the case realize, or they find out in investigating, that Leith has two stepchildren. He has Angela, who was there, she's fine, and Christopher Pritchard, who is who we're going to talk about the most. Leith was pretty rich. He was involved in dry cleaning, I think. So he was worth about $2 million. And he had recently just inherited about an extra million from his parents, who died.
Just a cool extra mil on top of
yeah,
that?
Yeah, he was rolling in it. He had the dry cleaning. He had some money from his inheritance. Things were going well.
And what year was this? Sorry, did you say?
This happened in 88.
Okay, thank you.
So Chris is a little bit suspicious. I guess the investigation's kind of dragging on, and Chris refuses to take a polygraph test. His mother and sister had passed, so it was no problem, but he didn't want to take a polygraph test, which just FYI, I don't think polygraph tests are all that accurate. I think since then people have realized that those tests can be, like, the results of that test can be faked pretty easily, and you can trick it into thinking that you're calmer than you are. So I don't know. I don't think I would take a polygraph test right now. So,
but the thing is that, like, yeah, maybe you wouldn't take a polygraph test right now, but if your stepdad had been murdered and you didn't do it, I would be like, yes, polygraph test me, because I know that I'm truthful. You know?
I thought I heard that polygraphs you can't really use as, like, evidence.
That did end up happening.
Yeah.
I think now cops, and I could be wrong about this, but cops can use the results of polygraphs to help the investigation. I don't think they hold up in a court anymore.
It sounds like it's more just a, like, it's not, the test itself is a test. Whether you'll take it or not is more, like, indicating
sure
your involvement just because of the perception around polygraphs without the actual results leading to any specific implications.
Yeah.
The polygraph test.
So the investigation's going on, and after some time, it turns out some of Chris's friends, James Upchurch and Neil Henderson, get implicated in some kind of weird murder plot. And what do they do together in their free time? They play Dungeons and Dragons. This is the Dungeons and Dragons murder.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Chris Pritchard, James Upchurch, and Neil Henderson are freshmen in college, or they just finished their freshman year of college at North Carolina State University. Sounds like Chris and James had known each other since they were Cub Scouts, but Neil joins the group a little bit later. They play D&D together. They do drugs together. They fail at school together. The articles that I read, and I should say, my sources were Murderpedia, Wikipedia, and then this article by Hayes Clement, which was published in January of 1990 from, like, Greensboro. So I couldn't quite, I think it was in an archive. I couldn't quite figure out where this article came from, but it all was legit. And had a lot of quotes from the trial. Spoiler alert.
I love quotes from the trial.
This is a quote from the article by Hayes Clements. Quote, "The trio had been playing the game regularly during summer school. The game is D&D. At the expense of grades. And when Pritchard and Henderson stopped by his apartment in early July, Henderson says, the talk was all sorts of strategies and make-believe, at least initially." So there's a weird murder plot happening. Henderson, one of the friend that kind of joined later, thought that they were going to rob Chris's mother and father because Chris is just getting really down on his parents. He thinks that he's owed more money than he's getting. And his stepfather's so rich, he's like, why don't you give me some of that? So he hired Upchurch and Henderson to kill his stepdad and his mother so he could hasten his $2 million inheritance. He was going to give, this is my favorite part, he was going to give his friends $50,000 each and a fast car.
And a fast car. Well, good.
Upchurch was going to get a Porsche, and Henderson was going to get a Ferrari, according to this article by Hayes Clement.
Oh, so it wasn't to do the crime. It was part of the reward for doing the killing.
Well, we'll get to that. There's a little bit of like a boy gang feel to this, and there's also money involved.
I don't want to like put words in these guys' mouth, but when did they have that conversation? Like, man, what kind of car do you want after you kill my parents? Dude, you gotta give me a Porsche, man.
Oh no, I'm gonna get a Ferrari because it's sick in the doors.
That's nice. I'll definitely buy you one of those after you kill my parents.
Oh, I can't wait to spill their blood and get a car.
It might have been playing D&D when they plotted the murder. I don't know. That seems to be what they did together.
It could be, but like, I don't know. There's a lot of crosstalk in D&D about like, it's easy to get off on tangents. You know, you finish a battle and then you're like, man, oh, hey, were we going to kill my parents next week or the week after?
Just slip it in
because you don't want to forget it. You get wrapped up in the session. It's super easy to like, you want to plan that stuff out. So I could see it coming up during the playing. Yeah.
Yeah. Make sure you put it on your calendar and then next week I'll level up your Elfard.
Yeah. Next week, make sure to come in with like all of your level up done and also an intricate plan for how you're going to murder my parents.
Well, you want to hear how they wanted to do it?
Please. Yes.
The first iteration, they were going to plan an accidental death by planting a broken fuse in the electrical box, putting gasoline all over the walls and setting a fire, and then their family is going to die in their beds. I guess he didn't care if his sister died in this scenario. So in preparing for this, he made a meal and he slipped sleeping pills into it to give to them so they wouldn't wake up and get out of the house when the fire was going.
Wait, so he attempted this one?
He testified that the two men lost the fuse that they were trying to break in the car trunk door. So that plan just was like completely abandoned. They're like, we can't get this fuse broken enough to plant in the electrical box. So let's nix this. Let's start from scratch.
This has such college project vibes.
They're in college. They're freshmen in college.
Yeah. Like you have, it's like you're planning out a group assignment like weeks in advance and you're like, okay, we'll just like grab a fuse and we'll break it and that'll start a fire. Like no big problem. Like you set a piece of it as given. And then when it comes down to like executing that, like you're looking for, you say, oh yeah, we'll just read this book and we'll get the sources we need and then we'll write it real quick. And then you can't find that book. Like you can't smash the fuse and you're just fucked like last minute, the day before you're trying to kill your parents or turn in an assignment. And it's like, well, okay. So we were really banking on this fuse being breakable and it is just not. So we got to figure out something else.
Terry's got to do the PowerPoint.
He's going to bore them to death with this PowerPoint on World War II. I don't know.
We'll talk about World War II later.
Oh, yeah. Spoiler alert for Sophie's story. Sorry. I know what it is. Next, they think, oh, I know what's going to do this. Chris Pritchard testified that he wanted their deaths to be pretty quick and painless. I guess, hence the sleeping pills and the fire. So I don't understand his logic here. This guy's a fucking asshole.
Fire is not quick and painless.
No, it's definitely not. And anyway, so the next plan is to go get a machete so that somebody can chop their heads off.
Classically quick and painless.
No problem.
Classically quick and painless.
No problem at all.
Having a head chopped off with a blunt big knife.
Sorry, we can't do that because the Army Navy surplus store is closed. I can't get us a machete right now.
And we can't go another time.
No, we have to do this now. Apparently, this is all happening on like July 24th. They die. The stepdad dies and the mom is injured very, very late at night on the 25th going into the 26th of July. So they really are just like trying to throw things out there and see what sticks. Next he goes to Kmart. Chris Pritchard.
Next step, of course.
This isn't what the Rosie Army wanted.
The surplus store for the Army is closed. I gotta go to Kmart.
Kmart will have what I need for my murder.
And he got a hunting knife. This is the plan that works, unfortunately. So this is the plan. Upchurch is gonna enter the house with Pritchard's key, stage a break-in, and attack the stepdad and the mom, Bonnie, in their bed with a knife and a baseball bat. at this point, Chris has drawn a map of his house, and that's going to come in handy later. But I guess he drew this map for James to know where to go and maybe where his parents would be in the house. It's kind of unclear if it was a map of the street or if it was just like a map of the house.
This is another Dungeons and Dragons thing, definitely.
Oh, totally.
Like as you're going through like a dungeon, the DM usually has like a little bit of a map drawn for you to go through the rooms and like, oh, this room has the ogre in it, the ogre, and this room has a spike trap, and this room has my parents in it, who you're going to murder.
And then you have to beat the Minotaur.
And no, then you get $2 million, apparently.
In gold, Caitlin.
Yes. The last step of their brilliant scheme was for Neil Henderson to drive James Upchurch, the murderer, away from the Von Steins' house and back to college. Chris, the stepson, his plan is to stay on campus all night with other people so he has an alibi.
Well, that's the smartest part of this plan, I guess.
Classic college students. They did this on a Monday night.
Did you look it up?
Yeah, I just looked it up.
It was summer.
That's true.
So on the night of the 25th, they did exactly what I laid out. Pritchard gave Upchurch a key to his place. Upchurch let himself in, staged a break-in, beat and stabbed the stepdad to death, and nearly killed Bonnie, Chris's mom. So Neil Henderson is kind of an interesting character to me. He's the getaway driver / the one that kind of joined this group a little bit later. This is a quote from him. Quote, "At that time, I really didn't feel very good about myself and I needed friends. James Upchurch and Christopher Pritchett were my friends. Hoping the murder plot was an elaborate joke, he dropped Upchurch off near the house and then kind of thought that nothing was actually going to happen. Like they had really just been talking about this in D&D and it wasn't going to happen. But sadly, it did. And James Upchurch came back and Henderson says that James said, quote, I did it. I can't believe I did it. I never want to see that much blood again for the rest of my life.
Oh my God.
They stop 3 times on their drive back to college. They burn the map of the house and other evidence. They get rid of all the clothing that James Upchurch was wearing, and then they wash the car. So they do actually get away with this for about 11 months. But Neil Henderson eventually testified that, quote, the guilt he carried for the homicide wasn't so bad when he was busy, but whenever he had quiet time by himself, I'd remember what he, Upchurch, said that night.
Low insight check on that.
Yeah, it just eats away at him for a while, and it sounds like he was working at a Wendy's and was going to college and was just like, what's going on?
College and working at Wendy's sucks enough already.
Throw that you're a part of a murder plot on top of that, and you've got a recipe for disaster.
But I just, I feel sympathetic towards him, towards the getaway driver, but also, like, how elaborate do you think that this joke is? Like, they have the weapons, you're driving the car, you're at the house, he went inside.
With a knife.
Yeah.
And a baseball bat.
When do you say to yourself, oh, this is not a joke? I would have done it when he bought the knife, for real. I would have been like, oh no.
Yeah, I think by the time they had to go to Kmart, it should have been clear.
Hey, like, this might not be meant to happen. We broke this bolt. The army store's closed. Why are we doing this, guys? Let's go get stoned instead.
It says no. But I also feel bad because he really wanted friends and he was probably felt pressured to do it. And like,
yeah, it's a classic case of freshman year friends. You know, those people you glomp onto like right when you start college.
Oh my God.
And then after the first year, you realize that they suck.
Totally.
But in this case, they're murderers.
I'm so glad that we all got past that point, you guys. And that none of you have ever asked me to kill your parents, because I'm just telling you now, I won't do it.
But you'll drive, right?
Yeah, I'll drive. God damn it. We can all fit in a CRV. I think it'll be good.
Nah, you can't catch Seth and Suzanne. They split up.
Yeah, good luck driving to Alaska for me.
Okay, so I think that I'm just going to settle on, let's never ask each other to kill anyone. How about that?
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Darren.
Thank you for promising that.
I said okay.
So the cops find the map that they tried to burn, and it was linked to Chris Pritchard's handwriting. And then Neil Henderson, about 11 months after the murder, confesses to the police everything that had happened. And as pressure is building and they're going to trial, Chris Pritchard had kind of maintained his innocence for a while, but then when the death penalty is on the table, he confesses that he was the mastermind of this whole plot. And everything that he said was corroborated by what Neil Henderson had already told them. And in the trial, Neil Henderson and Chris Pritchard, the stepson, made a deal. They were allowed to plead guilty to lesser charges, and they weren't going to be put up for the death penalty, and they also had to testify against James Upchurch. Also, this is one part, this whole story is messed up, but this part really freaks me out. The poor mother, Bonnie, throughout all this, before her son confessed, like at the beginning of the trial, he was just living with her. Like they went back to, I don't know if they were living at the same place, but he was just living with her and she was maintaining his innocence. And like, it just, how could you live with yourself and live in the same house as your mother who you set up to be brutally murdered?
I mean, it's the psychopath stuff. It's the inability to connect those things in your brain. But yeah, that freaks me the fuck out.
Yeah, and Dungeons and Dragons really does like hammer the occult into the players' minds. Like it really, really makes them think that doing horrible things is okay because of witchcraft.
Are you blaming witchcraft?
I'm just saying there's nothing in the Bible about D20s.
Well said. Amen.
Jesus never crit.
And I want to circle back to the map for a second. Like they stopped three times. they were like, one time was just to burn the map. They didn't
and get rid of some other stuff. My favorite, one of my sources, I think it was Murderpedia, was like, the cops got lucky because a hog farmer saw a fire in the woods and put it out, and like they found this stuff. I don't know how much stock I put in that, but I love it.
Hog farmer.
I 100% believe it. Hog farmers are always the key. You got to talk to your local hog farmers and see what fires they
make sure he's putting out your evidence fire.
Oh, this looks like a murder evidence.
Make sure a hog farmer is not putting out your murder evidence fire, I should say. If you're trying to plan the perfect crime.
It's kind of an inversion of the hogs being involved in a murder, because I feel like the trope is that you feed bodies to pigs because they'll just eat anything. But in this case, the pigs helped solve the murder just a bit. Thanks, pigs. Thanks, hogs.
This is a quote from Bonnie, the mother. Quote, I didn't believe he could commit murder, but after he told me he planned the murders, I had to believe him. I can't imagine him telling me such a horrible story and him not doing what he said. That is heartbreaking.
She's his biological mother, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So James Upchurch is convicted of first-degree murder, assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill or seriously injure, conspiracy to commit murder, and burglary in the first degree. He was sentenced to death on January 30th, 1990. But his death sentence was set aside in 92, and he will be eligible for parole in 2022.
Oh, no.
Doesn't mean he's going to get it, but he will be eligible for it, which makes me want to die.
Do you think he still plays D&D in jail?
No.
No?
Well, I don't know, actually. Maybe. If he could get enough other inmates to do it with him, I guess.
I mean, what else have you to do?
What else do you have going on? Chris Pritchard and Neil Henderson were both convicted of murder in the second degree, which is aiding and abetting, an assault with a deadly weapon. Neil Henderson, so this happened in about 1990-ish. Neil Henderson got paroled in the year 2000, and he finished his parole in 2005, so he's a completely free man as far as we know. And Chris Pritchard, the mastermind and the stepson, was paroled in 2007, and now he's a born-again Christian.
God bless. He's definitely not playing Dungeons and Dragons anymore.
No, probably not. And that's the one of the D&D murders. There are kind of a few, it seems like.
Yeah, and I know that there was big backlash against D&D when it came out because it was like the heat of satanic panic time. And everyone was like, it's got demons in it.
If I had to align this Chris Pritchard character, I'd say he's probably neutral evil.
Yeah, because he's not chaotic. He did do a plan.
It was a very good one.
Yeah, but he's not lawful evil because it wasn't a good enough plan, I feel like.
No, he did have to go to several retail establishments before mm-hmm. he got what he needed. Great Bone Story.
Wow, what a murder.
We'll just cut that out in post.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Cut that out, Sophie, in the future.
Cutting it out right now. Goodbye.
Thank you. Creepy murder about D&D. I thought Darren would appreciate that. You both play D&D. I don't really, but I like to talk about murders with it involved.
How did this murder affect your opinion of D&D?
I think it's the same opinion I had before, which is it's just not really my game.
Sure.
It takes too long.
Yeah, we play.
Maybe I'm just not imaginative enough to like it.
That's not true for the not imaginative part. But we did play, I don't think we've talked about this on the podcast, but for my birthday was in August, Darren made a custom role-playing game for me for my birthday around the tropes of the television show Bones. And I played it with a couple close friends, Caitlin included. And it was so much fun. But you liked that, but it was a little long. It did go long.
No, I had fun with that. I just don't think, I think it was so tailored to what you like, Sophie. So I was going to like it too, no matter what. I love Bones. I love Sophie. I like this. That was fun. But I will say, if it's not so perfectly curated to what I like, there's mm-hmm. no way I'm going to sit around and do that. Mm-hmm. And if it's not with like my best buds, no, I'm sorry.
Yeah, the form of the thing being Bones was definitely tailored towards Sophie, but then secondarily tailored towards Sophie was that the murder was a human body mummified inside of a giant joint. So
the brother in the doobie. Yeah.
Well, I had fun. I was I played the Booth character, the agent.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, of course, the forensic anthropologist, who I named Dr. Pleasance Lennon. Well, thanks for sharing those terrible bones with us.
Those boys, those murder boys, what are they going to get up to next when they get paroled? Are they going to reform their old party and start playing Dungeons and Dragons again and plan out a new murder? Who knows?
I hope part of their parole was you cannot play any games.
No games, period.
Like, you're done. Card games, no. Board games, no. Trivia, fuck you. Yeah, I think that should have been part of their parole. No more games.
Neil Henderson rolls up to a party, you know, even at, like while he's on parole and someone's there just playing Yahtzee in the corner. He's like, oh, I can't be here. My parole officer's gonna nail me to the wall if he hears like I was anywhere near a game of Yahtzee.
Fuck, if someone's playing Monopoly at his house, he's fucked. He can't go home for days.
The house has to air out.
Yeah, get all that Monopoly energy out.
Yeah, how do you explain all of this? And the parole officer just has a handful of Monopoly cash.
I didn't want to play. They made me.
I haven't rolled dice in 20 years.
So, Darren, what's your bone topic?
I don't remember why, but not too long ago, I got kind of interested in astronaut remains as a thing. I think it might have been right after. What made me think of this? I mean, maybe just talking to you about this podcast or remains in general. But, oh, I know. I had just watched Ad Astra, which is a Brad Pitt movie that just features so much horrific space death. There's a moment where an astronaut is mauled to death by a space baboon.
What?
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, in this movie, which I really recommend, maybe not for YouTube, but if you're interested in, like, science fiction and a little some light horror motifs, Ad Astra's pretty damn good. But Brad Pitt is trying to get basically to Neptune, and to do that he has to like start on Earth and then go to the moon and then go to Mars and then take like a really long space flight from Mars to Neptune. On his way to Mars from the moon, the ship he's on picks up a distress beacon in like the asteroid belt or something, and they find this Norwegian shuttle or station that's just like empty. And as Brad Pitt's going through it with another member of that ship he was on, they get attacked by a baboon that was there for testing, and it had like broken out and killed all of the crew, and it killed the guy Brad Pitt was there with. And it's just horrible. It's horrible to watch, but it's a great movie.
So you're talking about a baboon killing Brad Pitt in space?
Yeah, that's my story. No. But watching that movie made me think about real humans who have died in space or in the pursuit of space flight. And I think initially I was going to talk about the Columbia, because I'd done a little bit of research into that, but I couldn't find anything like super... it's all sad, obviously. But with that one, it was more like that ship broke up on reentry, going 16 times the speed of sound, and essentially covered like 2,000 miles from Louisiana to Texas in debris, because it was just came down at like such an angle and such a speed. And they found remains, but not a lot. I think they ultimately only recovered 40% of the entire ship or shuttle, anything that could have been recovered. So I do think they found remains maybe of every crew, but I can't find a lot of details. So I went for a smaller, more succinct story from the early days of space travel that had a very specific sort of a thesis to it, let's say. I maybe want you guys to like look up a picture for reference, just so you kind of know what I'm talking about. If you could Google Vladimir Kormarov, it should be probably one of the first pictures, a black and white photo of some pretty gnarly remains.
Is it a bunch of guys in front of a skeleton?
Kinda, yeah. Yeah. So Vladimir Kormarov was a cosmonaut in the mid-60s. His space flight on the Soyuz 1, and this was in 1967, made him the first cosmonaut to fly into space more than once. So Yuri Gagarin, who was his best friend, was the first man in orbit, essentially, ever. But for the 50th anniversary of the Soviet Union, Leonid Brezhnev, the leader at the time, basically decided that the space program was going to do something real cool to celebrate without really consulting them. So he's like, we're going to have one ship go up on one day and then another ship go up the second day and have a little crew swap and send back down the first guy. And that first guy was Vladimir Kormarov. And the whole time leading up to this flight, everyone is like, this isn't going to work. These ships are fucked. They are not ready. None of the tests went well. And Kormarov was selected to go up with his backup for anything should happen to him being Yuri Gagarin. And Yuri was like, don't let Vladimir go. Like, I'll go. And Vladimir's like, you're not going. I'm going. It can't be you. It has to be me, because you have to stay behind. Like, they were very, neither of them wanted the other one to go.
Because they're best friends and they don't want anything to happen to each other.
So they knew it was a death mission.
It was pretty much certain that it wouldn't work.
I just want to understand. One rocket goes up and the person in that rocket has to get to a different rocket in space?
Yeah, it was going to be a docking procedure. So the plan was that two Soviet space vehicles would launch into space and perform a dramatic orbital docking that would allow cosmonauts to move between the ships. So kind of like how a shuttle can connect to the International Space Station now. So the first capsule would launch with Kormarov inside, and then the next day, Soyuz 2 would take off with two additional cosmonauts. The two vehicles would meet, dock, Kormarov would crawl from one to the other, exchanging places with a colleague, and he would come home in Soyuz 2. Brezhnev made it very clear he wanted this to happen. Yuri Gagarin wrote like a 10-page memo and gave it to a friend of his in the KGB, basically saying all the reasons why this was a bad idea and why it shouldn't happen, but no one would pass it up to Brezhnev because they were so afraid of him, because the leader of the Soviet Union is basically a dictator with unlimited power at that point.
Yeah, I think it would be hard to be the guy that said, I'm sorry, sir, but we can't do the rocket.
Okay, so this was Kormarov's quote. If I don't make this flight, they'll send the backup pilot instead. That's Yura, and he'll die instead of me. We've got to take care of him. Kormarov then burst into tears. That was him talking to someone about it before he went. Truly tragic.
So sad.
So to sort of cut out a lot of space tragedy and jargon, so Komarov goes up and Soyuz 1, and it already starts going bad, like, as soon as he's in orbit. He can't quite get the alignment right for when the next one would come up. The solar panels failed to deploy, which means it doesn't have enough electricity, and the navigation equipment is not working correctly. It's not working. So they scrap the launch of the second ship that he was supposed to switch into. So that one never even goes up. And he basically is trying to get it back down to Earth at this point. As he gets it into a descent, he tries to launch the parachute. It doesn't work. And I think he's just slowly losing altitude without really being able to control it. And so they call him, like, on the video phone. Because this is the 60s, the United States was able to spy on a lot of Soviet radio transmissions. So we, like the US, was able to intercept a lot of these communications that were happening as they were happening. So even if the Soviet Union would never release this, it has been released. And as Komarov was headed to his doom, United States listening posts in Turkey heard him crying in rage, cursing the people who had put him inside a botched spaceship. He told the ground control officials he knew he was about to die. The Soviet Premier Alexei Kosygin called on a video phone, which was a thing in 1967, I guess, to tell him he was a hero. His wife also called him. It's just brutal. Some translators, like, the last thing they heard him say was, "Heat is rising in the capsule." He also used the word "killed," presumably to describe what the engineers had done to him.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so it crashes into the Earth and he is killed instantly, obviously. Yuri Gagarin is very vocal about it being a completely botched mission. They essentially sentenced him to die for a publicity stunt. But the reason I sent you the picture is because Komarov demanded it before he launched, that if he died, he wanted an open casket funeral because he wanted to send a message to the government officials who had caused his death. He knew the capsule was unsafe and that he would very likely die. He knew he would not be returning alive, so he made the demand before launching. His final revenge was forcing his superiors to look at what they had done.
Damn.
And just to wrap it up, Komarov was honored with a state funeral in Moscow, and his ashes were interred in the Kremlin Wall Necropolis at Red Square, which is maybe something that is a future episode of the Kremlin Wall Necropolis. That just sounds like it has a lot of interesting info in it.
Yeah, I'm writing that one down.
The American astronauts requested the Soviet government to allow a representative to attend, but were turned down. Komarov was posthumously awarded his second Order of Lenin and also the Order of Hero of the Soviet Union.
Oh, and I think, poor guy.
Yeah, and when we went to the moon, I believe this was Apollo 11, like the first lunar mission that was fully successful. They left a plaque up there of all of the astronauts who had died sort of trying to get to that or an early space flight. So American astronauts and Soviet astronauts, including Vladimir Komarov, are on that plaque.
Yeah, because he just died because the Soviet dictator was like, let me show you people how big my dick is, pretty much.
That was the space race, pretty much.
God.
Looking at those remains, he knew what he was doing. Even if he didn't know what he was going to look like when he came back to Earth, that's a clear message. You can't tell. I was just looking at it. You can't tell which side is his head and which side is his feet.
We'll post a picture of it.
Yeah, it's a little unclear, yeah, what exactly of the remains is remains. But I think, and I don't know exactly what this means, but what I was able to read was that the only piece of him that survived the crash was like a chipped heel bone. So maybe that's the only piece that was like easily identifiable.
I wonder what's there on that table then.
Yeah. This article that I read says, his body turning molten on impact.
Yeah, so it's probably partly him, partly the ship.
His suit, probably.
Well, we can say that he's very, very, he's extremely brave.
He's a badass. The open casket thing before you go is just like, hey, fuck you. This is what you're going to do. And you have to look at it and deal with the consequences when I get back.
Yeah. Especially in a government that had like that much control over its own image to not only like hear that demand, but honor it is kind of interesting too, because I'm sure they, you know, they had the ability not to, but they decided to do it anyway, even if that was outside of the immediate government control, like whatever group put together the memorial service. That image is like what maybe, because that's something that's like stuck in my memory for a while, is whenever I saw that. So it was interesting to look into it. And Yuri Gagarin is definitely like the secondary hero of the story, because up until even the last minute, he was trying to get on the ship instead.
Yeah, I just feel horrible because he also presumably had to go to that open casket funeral.
Oh, certainly. And Yuri also, just to keep the sadness rolling, he died in an experimental jet crash like a year later.
Damn it.
Well, maybe they met up in the afterlife and played a good game of D&D together. I'm going to cut that out.
You can't. You can't cut it out.
I can. I'm the one who edits the podcast.
Yeah, she can do whatever she wants, unfortunately.
I own you.
Oh, yeah. You got me talking a lot about how great Russia is in there. I'm worried about my public image.
Oh, no. I'm just going to clip it together.
Darren loves Putin.
Darren loves Putin. Speaking of things that are tragic and beyond comprehension and a bit of a bummer, I would like to tell the two of you about the ghost ship, the SS Orang Medan.
Ooh.
You know anything about this, Turbo Derbo?
Is this on Loch Ness?
No.
Okay, I'm thinking of a different ghost ship.
This is a different ghost ship. All right, here we go. Making my notes bigger. All right, here we go. So our story starts at some point around either June 1947 or, conversely, February of 1948. Two American vessels, the City of Baltimore and the Silver Star, were navigating the Straits of Malacca, which is like a main shipping channel between the Indian and the Pacific Ocean, when they picked up several distress messages from the nearby Dutch merchant ship, the SS Orang Medan. And I don't know if I'm saying that right. So these messages, so the first one that they picked up, and these were in Morse code, was all officers, including captain, dead. Lying in chart room on bridge, probably whole crew dead. And then there's a bunch of kind of staticky, fuzzy Morse code. And then the last message that's sent out is, I die.
I don't like this already.
Nobody does. So the Silver Star goes to try to locate this ship, and the ship was approximately 50 miles from where her like indicated position was. And when the crew of the Silver Star boarded the ship, which seemed undamaged, they found that the decks were littered in the corpses of the crew. There were dead crewmen in the chart rooms. They found the body of the radio operator who had been sending those messages. And even the dog was dead. I know. And it said that when they found all these corpses, their eyes were wide with fear and their mouths were open like they were screaming, which a little injection here, something Caitlin and I have talked about before, but the faces of a corpse don't dictate what was happening to them at the time.
Yeah.
When you die, all your muscles relax and in your face and in your jaw. And so if nobody sets your mouth closed or sets your eyes closed, you're going to look like you're staring straight ahead with your mouth open screaming.
Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be good.
Yeah. R.E. the soap lady.
Right. Have you heard about this, Darren?
No, I don't think so.
There's a corpse that they have at the Mütter Museum, which is run by the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. That's a medical oddities. But this lady, she's buried in the ground. She's saponified, which means she developed an outer layer of soap out of her skin. But her face is like, she looks terrified. She's looks like she's having a real good scream.
But and she's on display in the Mütter Museum, but there's no... She hasn't been like mummified or anything. She's like perfectly preserved because of this process of saponification. And she looks like she's screaming too.
Yeah. Yeah, she sure does. I just looked it up and that's...
Are you scared?
I'm a little scared, but I think it looks like the Mütter Museum.
Either.
It looks like they do sell soap on a rope of this lady.
They super do. They love her, and we do too.
They can cash in on that.
That's okay.
They have our permission.
Yeah, this is horrible. I don't like looking at this.
Well, imagine a fresher version of that.
Now.
Yeah, like that, with the big mouth open. Okay, so they find all these bodies on the deck and in the various parts of the ship that look like, and they say that the rigor mortis had set in and that their arms were reaching out as if they were trying to fight something or someone. They said that there was no survivors and the corpses seem to be decaying faster than they should. I'm skeptical about this as well because I read somewhere that the local temperature of the area that they were in was like around 100 degrees, 110 degrees. So that's a lot of bloating. And like, if they were there for, you know, a period of time, they could get gross fast. After they've discovered all of these dead on this ship, they decide the Silver Star is going to try to tow this ship away and see if they can kind of investigate what's happened. They need to get it to somewhere else. But just as they're starting to hook it up to tow it away, a fire suddenly breaks out in the ship's number 4 cargo hold, forcing the whole rescue party to get off of the ship. And as soon as they're like off the ship, giant explosion happens that literally lifts the ship out of the water and then sinks that sucker to the bottom of the ocean.
Whoa.
Hi. Ghost ship.
Holy ship.
Holy ship. So I have more information. I'm just going to say my sources really quickly. I have a great article from Ripley's, believe it or not, actually. Wikipedia, of course. There was an extremely helpful article on a website called D, that's spelled DE173. That's kind of has some articles on different nautical mysteries. And then there was a great video from the Infographics channel on YouTube. So what's even more puzzling about this ship? So we have this story, right, of this ship and everybody's dead, and then it explodes and it sinks, so we have no evidence, right? Well, it's iffy whether or not this ship actually existed at all.
Uh-oh.
People have checked the records to see, like, shipping records, to see kind of where this ship was going or where it came from. And it doesn't appear on the Lloyd's Shipping Register, which was a big register of ships at the time. And this could be for a couple of reasons. The first reason maybe being that it was registered in Sumatra, because the vessel's name kind of translates to man from Medan, which is a Sumatran island. So it might not have been registered with this British shipping company, although I think it had everybody. I think that was kind of the point. And there's also not a lot about the Silver Star, which is the ship that found the Orang Medan. And there's a couple of possible reasons for that as well. The ship could have been operating under a different name, the Santa Juana, operating under a different shipping company at the time. But also, this whole incident wasn't mentioned in the logs of the Santa Juana or the Silver Star. But in reports, the Silver Star is mentioned by name. Kind of weird, right?
Yeah.
Things aren't adding up.
You are absolutely right. And speaking of numbers, let's talk about the dates when it might have happened. Because there's a couple. So, like, the first newspaper articles about it appeared in a Dutch-Indonesian newspaper called The Locomotive, or, oh, I am not even going to attempt that Dutch name. Sorry. It's called The Locomotive. But these articles came out in installments on, like, February 3rd, February 28th, and March 13th, 1948. But some people say that it happened in 1947. And then there are some reports that are, like, as early as 1939 and 1940. So kind of hard to pinpoint when it actually went down.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? Do you have any idea from your research?
I'm not quite sure. It might be connected to some of the theories that they have about them, which I'll get to in a second.
Sorry, I jumped the gun.
No, that's fine. That's a super valid question. But I just wanted to tell you some of the things that lend a little bit more legitimacy to it. The first official mention of it is in May of 1952 by the United States Coast Guard in a document called the Proceedings of the Merchant Marine Council. So if the Coast Guard's talking about it, I feel like that's makes it sound less like an old wives' tale, you know?
Yeah, they're talking through the like procedures taken if you find a ghost ship, maybe.
I mean, Coast Guard's gotta have ghost ship protocol, right?
I'm pretty sure that's a Mission Impossible movie, actually.
Yeah, as soon as I said it, I was like, that's a name for something. Operation Ghost Ship Protocol.
I'm like, I don't think that would make a great Mission Impossible movie, actually, because there's not a lot of space for Tom Cruise to run around on that on a ship.
What if he was a ghost already? Like, his whole character arc, he was a ghost.
Yeah, I guess he could run anywhere, then.
And then he comes back to life at the end so they can make more Mission Impossible
movies. Yeah, just like The Mummy.
So another thing that makes it a little bit more legit, and this one you can take as you will. There was a letter written to the CIA about this, and it was written by this is in 1959. It was written by this guy, C.H. Mark Jr., and he sent a letter to the assistant to the director of the CIA, Alan Dulles, and the letter was quote-unquote top secret. But then it was released, it was like declassified in 2003. And so he wrote this letter. We know that Mark wrote this letter, but we don't know who he wrote it to. That's still redacted. So this guy, Mark, wrote a lot of letters to the CIA, but he didn't work for the CIA. He just wrote letters to the CIA. So his legitimacy is like, eh.
Maybe. Yeah, can't anybody write a letter to the CIA?
Yeah, but do they keep anybody's letters to the CIA secret?
Fair point. Fair point. I guess I'm just saying in general, if I wanted to write a letter to the CIA, I could. I could keep it and never send it. I could send it and hope they never get it. I don't know.
I hope it gets lost in the mail.
Yeah, it's an experiment, actually.
Yeah.
See how shitty our postal service is right now.
Yeah, I'm going to mail the CIA a coconut.
Do it.
I'm going to mail them a shoe.
You should. So Mac basically hears this cool ghost story and thinks, you know who I'm going to tell? The CIA. And he thinks that it's because this ghost ship holds the secret to what might have happened to many airplane and ship disappearances. He also in his letter, I read this letter, by the way, I found it and I read it and it's wild. Because he then goes on. So he says that the ship holds all the secrets of disappearance and the secrets of the sea. And he also talks about fiery spheres coming up out of the sea and floating in the air. And he goes on to say that he thinks that the Orang Medan will hold the secrets of the sea and that it might have something to do with these fiery orbs.
The orbs. It's all about the orbs, clearly.
Clearly it's all about the orbs.
Was the ship just transporting orbs?
It might have been just chock-a-block full of orbs.
What I like about the descriptions of some, like, supposedly paranormal stuff is it sounds normal up until a certain point. It's like when you were describing, like, the fiery orbs, it's like, okay, that could be, like, fuel, like, ignited fuel from the ship that's leaked into the ocean and is rising up in big globs. I'd buy that. And then it's like, and then it hovered in the air for a second. And then it's like, no, that don't happen.
Oh, you've gone too far, Mac. So let's talk theories. Now, the first one, methane coming out of the ocean. It comes up from the ocean floor and it's flammable. And if it mixed with any sort of weird stuff on the ship, could have made an explosion or could have asphyxiated people. Iffy.
Floating orbs.
Floating orbs.
Full of methane.
Full of methane. Yep. That's what I was thinking, though. These bubbles of methane maybe got caught on fire somehow. Is that how science works?
Ocean fire.
Ocean fire. You know, ocean fire. Ocean man, make ocean fire.
Are you talking about Aquaman?
Sure. Aquaman, make a big fart, light it on fire.
He would do that.
So the next theory, which is probably the most likely-ish, is that the ship was carrying lethal and highly illegal toxic chemicals when they accidentally mixed somehow and caused fumes that asphyxiated or poisoned the crew and made the ship blow up. Dangerous wartime chemicals is what I wrote here. And this would explain kind of some of the stuff Caitlin was talking about of why it's not on like registries and things. This could be part of why. Because I have a little quote here from Andrew H. from that website I was talking about, D173. He said, the Geneva Protocol of 1925, ratified by 33 nations, outlawed all chemical weapons, so the transport of such chemicals would have been done under utmost secrecy, and with a ship not properly registered with a foreign crew, all records of the voyage hidden or altered so that the government could save face. That's a pretty good point. Do it with a poorly registered ship. Do it with a crew that is, you know, willing to do it.
Mm-hmm. Get a dog.
Oh, poor dog.
But it was possibly potassium cyanide or nitroglycerin or some sort of nerve gas. And that possibly mixing with seawater could have formed toxic gases.
Potassium also burns when it gets wet, when it gets in contact with water. So,
well, that makes a lot of sense.
Orbs. Big chunks of potassium, you throw them in the water. Like, literally, that's what it does. When you throw it in water, it makes little fireballs.
Have you done that?
Not personally, but I've seen it done.
That's what we're doing after this.
Meet me at Lake Washington.
So, another theory that is a big bummer is that it was possibly carrying chemical or biological weapons for Unit 713. Unit 713 was a covert biological and chemical warfare research and development unit of the Imperial Japanese Army that undertook lethal human experimentation during the Second Sino-Japanese War during World War II. This was a unit of the Japanese Army that did, like, if you think about the Nazi experiments, they were, I don't want to get into it too much, but I read one account that they had people basically tied to like stakes in concentric circles, and they would set off a grenade in the middle and assess the damage of what happened to people at different distances. That's kind of the tamest one that I found to explain.
Yeah, basically just, you know how like Sherlock Holmes would do stuff to corpses to try to gather information on like, oh, this body was whipped, that's why it has these bruises. They would do that, but with murder.
And like to figure out how to do new kinds of surgery and things like that. It would give people frostbite. And it was, so it might have been in conjunction with that particular unit. But it could have also been ghosts.
Sure, sure.
Sure.
Keep it light.
I read ghosts or pirates or ghost pirates.
Oh man.
Take your pick, really.
Yeah. I don't think pirates is a viable option because pirates do a slash and not a lot of, and these bodies didn't have visible injuries on them. And I feel like pirates aren't like, I'm gonna come up behind you and stick some arsenic in your mouth and I'm gonna leave without a trace because I'm a pirate.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you guys think?
I think there was something, a chemical on there for the war or for some kind of nefarious purposes, and they didn't know how to handle it, and they all got killed, and then it made the ship explode.
Yeah, you know, especially when handling like dangerous chemicals, there's so much specific things you have to do to keep stuff like that from happening. That's why trucks have built-in signs that say like, this truck is carrying this kind of flammable chemical or poisonous gas or whatever. So if they were trying to transport that kind of stuff and keep it a secret, they probably wouldn't be doing the necessary safety inspections to go along with that. And that makes me think, yeah, mixed up some bad chemicals, poisoned the whole crew. It'd have to be a pretty powerful gas, just since you can open doors on a ship and some windows, considering it got like the crew in the cabin and the crew on the bridge and then the guy sending the SOS even. And the dog. Man, just to like your last message to be typing out in Morse code, I'm dying.
I die.
There's a video game based off this shipwreck as well, Darren.
Oh, is it the Oberdin?
It's called Man of Medan or something, oh, right?
I don't know that one.
The Dark Pictures Anthology. It's an interactive drama survival horror video game.
Oh, the Orang Medan, yeah. Yeah, some of the concept art that I'm seeing when I Google it is like faces that look very ghosty that are like, they just look like the Joker. They're just faces frozen into horrible grins.
I mean, I'm guessing that's supposed to be the crew members, which is very disrespectful.
To a thing that maybe didn't happen.
The ship might not have existed, but a guy wrote the CIA about it.
That's true. He wrote a letter.
And I mean, there has to be people were on the other ship too. There had to have been witnesses.
That's one thing that's iffy though as well. So initially I read that there were no survivors. And then I read that there was possibly a lifeboat that went on shore in Fiji that was a survivor of this shipwreck, and all of the six other guys in this boat are dead, but I'm fine. And also, I read somewhere else that the crew of the Silver Star didn't talk to, like, press about it.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a tricky one. Ghost ship.
I think the fact that we, like, can't really nail down the date when it happened.
Yeah, that's a major strike against them. Mm-hmm. Or it's a major strike for the idea that somebody was really trying to hide this ship. And what happened to it? What a conundrum.
What a conundrum. Well, thank you for joining us for these bone stories, Darren.
Of course. Thanks for having me. I'm thoroughly bone chilled from the last one and bone thrilled from the first one.
That's all we can ask for. And before you go, I just have to ask, Darren, what's your favorite bone?
Oh, that's a great question. I think last time I was asked this one, I said the scapula, which is the shoulder blade.
Yeah,
let's go with a scapula. It's such a weird flat bone.
It's a fun word to say too.
It sounds a little like spatula, which is also like a weird flat thing, which makes me, you know, a little bit of, which are they, is it the same root word, is one named after the other? I'm not gonna look it up, but I like to think about it.
You punched me in my spatula.
It's a big flat target.
Just like me.
Jesus Christ.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bon voyage.
Bon voyage.
Thanks for listening to Anything Bones. Follow us on Instagram or Facebook at Anything Bones Podcast, or email us at anythingbonespodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you to Nick Kruger for our spooky music, and Steven Vetteroff
at Chubby Scrubby on Twitter
for our jazzy vocals. And thank you to Camilla Franklin
at Camilla Strader on Instagram
for our beautiful bony artwork. Please rate, review, and subscribe.
Bones!